Do you solemnly sincerely and truthfully declare it to the parents that are the evidence you have of the effort for what shall be the truth and whole truth and nothing but the truth?
Your full name is David Creed.
Yes.
And you are employed as a game bird manager for the Auckland Waikato Fish and Game Council based in Hamilton.
Yes.
And you have produced a statement of evidence dated the 28th of July 2023, and you participated in joint works conference on the 30th, 31st of August and the 5th of September. Do you confirm to the best of your knowledge and belief that your evidence is true and correct?
Yes.
Your Honour, I have a few questions to ask you. Now, I wish to put an email to you, Mr. Clay. You're familiar with this email which was sent from Mr. Conway to myself following the questioning of Ms. May when she provided evidence in court.
Yes.
Can I provide any exhibit number for this document, sir? I think we're up to 7. In the female, Ms. May advises that no formal decisions of council on crime and acting abuse and fresh water policy reviews have been made. Council supported an engagement process that has drafted NFPO's notions and printed. And in discussions with staff, council has supported the alignment of FMU boundaries with the integrated catchment management zone boundaries in as much as was possible. Can you please advise the court what you understand the integrated catchment management zone boundaries to be?
It's monitoring of the baseline. Deliverables in terms of catchment management practices, i.e. river works or whatever.
Okay. Now, in paragraph 1.5 of your evidence, you say that a large part of your work involves managing habitat enhancement and restoration projects around wetlands, lakes and rivers. Can you comment on the practicalities which can arise through larger setbacks, such as of 10 metres, with, for example, wind control?
Yes, I've been involved in a few projects where we have implemented large setbacks, 10 or even greater. From a practical perspective, we try to mitigate any of those potential issues that could arise, because yes, you didn't want to manage some of those areas moving forward. So one thing, for example, that we commonly do is we put a gate in that would allow access both to get stock out of those areas potentially, to say the natural stock managers come across the river and then have their events figure them out. But also we could leave a margin normally between the fence and the start of the riparian planting. 2.5 metres wide, which is sort of a case of the equates, and simply they'll obviously also right here in planting, we normally have a 2 to 3 year program of weed control in those areas. But then up to that point, if the planting's been done well, generally the maintenance requirements are quite low. As the plants establish, shading comes into effect, which tends to progressively shade out any weed species that may be within that area. And then really it just becomes more of an issue about maintaining the area around the field lines and that access to the access within those areas.
Thank you. My final question for you is around shallow lakes and sign of bacterial blooms. Now, I understand these can occur in the summer. Can you comment on this issue in the PC1 catchments recently and in the current year?
Yes, so I mean, there are some bacterial blooms that are not necessarily isolated to summer. In fact, unfortunately, some of our lakes can be now have year-round cyanobacterial warnings on them. Obviously many of our lakes are no longer fit for any forms of contact with creation, and unfortunately that does extend year-round for some. So I just sent an email a few days ago warning about 4 lakes that are already experiencing very high cyanobacterial levels that will make them unsuitable for contact with creation, and that's relatively early. And in the case of Lake Waikato, for example, that lake is already 30 times the red alert level, which is based on human health risks, and which is another limit now. So that's extremely high.
And how, in your view, has that affected the community in terms of lake values?
I guess in general terms, lakes historically were sort of the jewel of the crown, important for a whole lot of community initiatives. There's Hank Kyle, the reaction. Many of the lakes have still got sort of residual remnants of boat sheds and bathing sheds and so on, which, and in fact, you know, we still have some old times in our organisation where they have their high school swim school certificates of when they used to swim in Lake Waikato. And quite frankly, nowadays, you wouldn't want your dog to go near it in case it produces the sign of bacteria. So, I guess within the space of a relatively short period of time, most of our lakes have collapsed from being a jewel in the crown and an important resource for the community to now being a place where you can either go and visit or do any contact with creation.
Thank you. Please remain and answer questions.
Afternoon, Mr. Keith. Mm-hmm. I want to start off with the Lake FMUs and your evidence on that, and then your evidence you raised issues about categorising Lake FMUs by geomorphological origin.
Yes.
And at paragraph 10.13 of your evidence, if you've got that there, the call that's 11319. Page 179, tab 4. You're saying that paragraph, you consider that the preferred approach is for each lake to have its own FMU. In some areas, there are clusters of lakes in close proximity that have similar drivers of ecosystem health, such as Horsham Downs or the Waipa Peak Lakes. In these subcatchments, lakes could be grouped into the relevant FMU. In your opinion, the current FMU categorisation for lakes is fundamentally flawed.
Yes.
So that's your evidence. Now, I just wonder, have you got the, in front of you is the council post-conferencing version of the provisions? There's copy on the table there if you don't have it. Right in front of you, just on the corner of the table there.
Thank you.
If you go to page 8, which is map 3.11-1, that's the FMU map.
Yes.
I just want to be clear about what you're suggesting in terms of these lake FMUs. We're talking the everything except the lavender or blue colour, I gather, the yellow, orange, green and red shapes. So you're suggesting that those should be broken up into different lakes and the catchments boundaries defined? Is that what you're suggesting?
So I guess the critical aspect of that, this is a great individual in the second place on that is involved, is that lakes need a lake-by-lake management approach, including targeted nutrient reductions for individual lakes. And from my perspective, the way that the FMUs are currently established, and the way that their targets translate through from those FMUs, that is not facilitated within way this is categorised currently. So my suggestion is that, yes, in the absence of any more nuanced approach which would take those considerations into account, then having an FMU position into that would be a much better approach. Now, I guess the other part of this map, which is also covered in the joint statement, that it is a large area with some very small lakes and lake catchments, and it is not necessarily easy to even see where some of the lakes are in here, let alone try and work out what the catchments are. So that's more of a mapping issue, I guess.
Yep, so that exercise of breaking it up and defining the catchments and identifying the lakes, is that work been done?
So we know the lakes are, we know the sub catchments that sit in. So I would think we'll be around for the training exercise.
So you're saying the entire sub catchment that a lake sits in should be identified as a lake FMU?
So, well, yes, for a lake management approach, you need to know all the areas that you can into that lake. So you can't part of the FMU for that lake.
Okay, so have those areas been defined on a map that drain into the lakes?
Not with the PC1, but they are, those maps will be available. Not within, so not within the software. So.
Okay, but they're not available to the sport in terms of the relief.
Not right now, not at all.
And you're aware that the NOAC process under the NPSFM requires regional councils to identify FMUs in the region?
Yes.
And go through a process to identify values, environmental outcomes, identify attributes and set target attributes for the FMUs?
Yes.
So the issue can be considered further through the freshwater policy review process, can it?
Yes, I would hope so.
And it's only a year or so before that needs to be notified?
That's my understanding, yes.
Okay, so I want to go now to paragraph 3.10.1 of the ordinance.
Yes.
Yeah, 3.10.1, which is on page
311.150. Yes, thank
you. And I gather you're concerned there that some FMU classes and lakes already have current states that are better than the national bottom lines in table D for lakes?
Yes, so a lot of the lakes that have been clumped together within these four FMU categories currently have attributes that are better than the targets, the long-term targets, the 80-year targets.
Yes, and your concern is that the target attributes space could somehow allow degradation of lakes that are already better than the bottom lines? That's your concern?
I guess more my concern is that it doesn't deserve, in my opinion, a very coherent approach to what needs to occur within those lakes moving forward. I don't think the whole water person team or the realms of planning, but I don't think there is a general acceptance that things can get worse within systems. I guess the point being that the way that PC1 is currently set up, in my opinion, there's nothing to stop it from getting worse than the intro, because we do not have concrete targets. Many of them.
terms of there being nothing to stop from getting worse, I just want to take you to the post-conferencing version again, and table D, which relates to weights. Which is on page 66 of the provisions.
Yes.
And then there's an asterisk by the 80 year in the row headings there, 80 year row headings. And it does say, so that's the 80 year target, and then there's an asterisk, and underneath it says, unless the lake is already of better water quality, in which case the water quality is not to decline. So the footnote does already require maintenance of water quality in lakes with attributes that are above the national bottom lines, doesn't it?
In theory, yes.
Moving on now to paragraph 11.10 of your evidence.
Yes.
In the third sentence there, you say, the ability now exists to set targets for individual lakes in the same manner as riverine subcatchments, and you support the setting of 10-year interim targets for lakes. That's right, isn't it?
Yes.
Have you calculated those 10-year targets?
No, I don't think so. So that is the evidence of Dr.
So Dr. Scarsworth's comment in the JWS is that volume-wide modelling of 21 lakes has been completed in a weights peer review, and the modelling of the full 38 lakes is in the process of being contracted. That's your understanding?
That's correct, yes.
Are you aware that that work still hasn't been completed at the time of this hearing? So again, the relief you're seeking is not before the court in the form that it can adopt, is it?
Not by now, as of today, no. However, I would say that it would be overly complicated to conduct some of that work, and yeah, there are obviously some ways there is the information available now, but it's not being presented to the court.
Okay, and that again can be something that's picked up through the freshwater policy review. Do you agree with that?
I'd hope so. If it's not a competitive standard use, I think again there's general agreement that this work needs to happen, that it is vital for lakes, that it is incorporated. And again, if it is to be done, and it will not be done through this process, then I would hope that it will be the council position that it will be implemented through that process, yes.
Okay, and this is just the last topic I've got, and it's about wetland narrative space. And you support inclusion of narrative targets in Table 3.11-1 as proposed by Dr. Robertson, one of the witnesses for the Director General. And at paragraph 4.12 of your evidence, you acknowledge that there is a paucity of monitoring data to implement wetland specific numeric targets. And then you support narrative targets as follows, and these are set out in the planning evidence of Ms. Maher on behalf of Fish and Game. I don't think we need to go there. I will just read it out. In the short term, maintain or improve the current state, and in the longer term, nutrient status is within the healthy range for the specific wetland type. Now again, I just want to go to the provisions. The post-conferencing version. again, just to objective one. Which is page 14.
Thank you.
So in relation to wetlands, this policy requires that wetlands other than treatment wetlands are both restored and protected, restored over time and protected. With the result that they are safe for people to swim in and take food from. That's correct, isn't it?
Yes, I think most of that is probably good for the swim, but yes, I guess it's captured in that broader objective.
Yeah, taking swimming very literally, but in terms of contact with the water,
for
recreational purposes,
specifically,
it's still a concept, yeah. And you'd agree that restoration requires betterment, would you?
In most cases, yes.
So water quality improvement is already required by that objective, isn't it, without the narrative attribute states?
Broadly, if I was just reading this, in isolation, I still think that it wouldn't be very strong or clear to me how that would be achieved in the wetlands.
Okay, going back to the longer term nutrient state, the requirement for nutrient status to be within the healthy range for the specific wetland. Again, being safe to swim in or at least have contact with and take food from would represent a healthy range in your view?
Not necessarily, not for wetlands, because there are ecosystem values for wetlands that may not translate to those values that you just pass. So it may not be that kind of recreation, for example, is not necessarily a value that is a priority.
But being safe to swim in and take food from would be an indicator of health, but not necessarily the full picture, is that what you're saying?
Not necessarily. No, I don't agree with that, so. Because they can be quite dependent, very positive things that we just supposedly. It wouldn't be accurate in my mind.
Okay, no further questions? Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Oh, yes, sir. Just one question, thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. McLean. Well, I just have one question, and it's in relation to the joint witness statement. So, if you could grab, and we've got what is the water quality joint witness statement.
Yes.
Can we just go to question 45, please? So in the next question, it's relating to CBP expansion,
mm-hmm.
and in relation to, is it appropriate to define sensitive subcatchments as proposed in Dr. Scar's lecture bottle? And then it goes on further about catchments in the Whangarei in Wetland, and those subcatchments that are already breached or are close to breaching national bottom lines. And then if you go over the page, in terms of the agreement to reach that conferencing, it says that if CBP their uses were allowed to expand, resulting in increased ocean and other contaminant losses, then catchments with sensitive water bodies, like lakes and wetlands, should be avoided. Then the second matter, therefore, agreement is we note that allowing increased nitrogen and or other contaminants in over allocated catchments will compromise achievement of and progress towards Table 3.11.1 targets. And then I note your comment at the bottom there. I think that's you in terms of wetlands, in terms of all wetlands should be considered, not just the Whangamaringa wetland. But my question, just my question for you, is in relation to the second matter agreed, do you know to what extent are the catchments in the lower Waikato FMU, to what extent are those over allocated?
So, in terms of all sub-catchments, rivers and lakes, or just wetlands that are
well, your knowledge in that area of those catchments, if you've got, if you know across the board, over water bodies, do you?
I don't specifically look at all the riverine sub-catchment areas, but certainly in terms of lakes and wetlands, certainly for lakes, obviously the more they're allocated because of the reductions that are required for and obviously wetlands. That work that was still being done at this stage, and therefore, we simply do not know that at this point in terms of what that over allocation might look like.
So it's over allocated, but you just don't know to what extent. Is that the answer?
Not necessarily for all wetlands, I just think we simply haven't got any evidence.
Don't you know they are?
Exactly. Right.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Fisher asked you some questions about the footnote in Table 3.11.1.2. And there's an asterisk here that says against the long-term states unless a lake is already of better water quality, in which case the water quality is to not decline. And you said, quotes, in theory, in quotes, that provided direction to maintain lakes. How could that policy intent be improved?
So there's several ways I think it could be improved. I mean, for starters, obviously doing the work that was also discussed in terms of those nutrient reduction required, and then ensuring that those attained would be the most appropriate way, but in the interim, at the very least, having the current state for lakes listed in the plan for those lakes where that monitoring and baseline information has been collected, but at least give some indication of the current state from which a measurement of which decline from could be taken. So I think that would be helpful. Obviously, we'll also indicate in those catchments for those lakes that are severely degraded what might be required in terms of actually bringing some of those lakes back. Because again, as has been discussed in the previous report of statements, in many instances, there will be requirements for very large scale nutrient reductions that still allow us even just to bring those lakes back to the shore line.
Thank you. Mr. Fisher also asked you about the modelling that Dr. Scales has undertaken for developing future attribute states for lakes or targets. Is it your understanding that Fish and Game seem to include 10-year or indeed 80-year actual target attribute states in the PC1?
No, not at all.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Pate. I want to ask about the classification of lakes based on the sort of ecological space was that the geomorphology of an environment provided a boundary condition within which the ecosystems function.
Yes.
So and I would have thought, okay, a lake that's surrounded by sand dunes that provides some sort of unifying thing where I would expect, you know, this lake surrounded by sand dunes is going to have similar characteristics to another lake surrounded by sand dunes and the various classifications that the regional council has put together there seem helpful. The marine lakes that are on volcanic landscapes, etc. So why doesn't that work?
So, I mean, I've concluded a piece of work that was provided or was done by the regional council, one of the biggest examples where they looked sort of those cohesions within those different frameworks and tried to look at it on the basis of the current epidemic categorisation, which coincided with the regional facilities. This is a multivariate problem identifying issues within lakes. And what was found within that piece of work is, unfortunately, despite those unifying characteristics that you discussed that led to that process of the lakes being formed, it did not plug together very well at all, in fact, in terms of how management actions or nutrient loads would affect those systems.
So the other characteristics like the nutrient loading, etc., override the
Yes, exactly. Right. Yeah.
Okay. And those other classifications, multivariate classifications that have been tried, do they produce coherent groupings of lakes?
Yes, I mean,
would be better management units.
Statistically speaking, yes, more of us. Yes. So there are these other processes, and I guess some of those were deliberated by the CSG, is my understanding, as well. And I think it was more from the fact that there was a shallow lakes framework that had already been developed, which had these four categories in them. So again, probably more for those more specific reasons that we've got a consistent framework in the way to which we have to translate that through to the plan. I would note that the shallow lakes framework, which has, I think Dr. Scarlett mentioned in his evidence, when you actually look at that, it gives no rationale as to why that categorisation process was used to define the shallow lakes in the first place. So again, I think to my mind it's still relatively unclear why that is an appropriate way to classify lakes at this stage. And there are certainly ways that are presented both in my list, but also Dr. Norris looks on behalf of the Director General at the local body hearing, presented certain other methodologies or ways that include the multivariate culture as well, by which lakes could be categorised, which would, in my opinion, also be within the four broad scale continuums.
So there is an evidence somewhere a classification of lakes that fish and game lakes would be better, that it would be appropriate for the court to make a decision.
Yes, I've got it in my evidence.
So where's that?
So that is on page 54.
Paragraph number
10.9. Okay. Is the table that I'm referring to. It's numeric around that. Yes, I guess, I mean, the critical thing for us is that, as agreed by everyone, is that the significant nutrient value, any categorisation will have flaws in it. When you categorise something across spatial scales and stuff, it might be ideal. So again, having treating lakes on an individual catchment basis is a much more mature approach. And the conversations I've been hearing with Dr. Scarlett, but I do understand that is the way that is in the proposal for the official plan review, is that we're looking at lake catchment, individual lake catchment, nutrient reduction. moment there are four that I know of, and I wouldn't be confident in saying that they are for 12 months of the year reaching the really early stage. So I think I said we should have gone on the top of the year looking at the data, but there are four on now.
I suppose the question that I really come down to, and following on, and it may well be that you've already answered this in what you said to Commissioner Nathan, does what's set out in Table 2, I think from what you go on to say, even what's set out in Table 2 doesn't itself provide a sufficient degree of discrimination or fine-tuning to address the particular problems of each lake. So you go on to say, ultimately, inherent variability will require different management actions. Is that right?
So yes, I think no matter which way you categorise it, there will be some different clauses,
sure,
whatever approach was used, at least it's a lake by lake basis. But I guess what I would say is that we have much more confidence in the approach outlined here than using the general model.
Over time, you might want to adopt a sort of a sieve approach, mightn't you, to do a rough characterisation to get things moving and then get down into detail rather than saying we need to have 73 separate management plans on day one.
Yes, I accept that, John. I guess what I would say there is that we've also been put through a relatively lengthy process in this particular plan change, and these issues, I guess, were signaled from our perspective relatively early on. So, yes, if there was some certainty of outcome that would become more granular as we move on and we have those more specific management outcomes moving forward, management plans for the specific plans, then it would give me much more confidence. Yes.
Well, in the first instance, separation distance is something that you're suggesting should be done for all lakes. So that is a single approach, isn't it?
It is. Again, it would not be perfect. But
I'm not saying on its own.
Yes.
I'm saying as a first step,
yes,
all 73 need separation from, say, farming-type activities or other activities where anthropogenic effects are likely to have adverse effects on them.
Can you clarify what you mean by separation?
Oh, well, no clearance, no farming, no areas of runoff within 20 metres at least of each of these lakes.
So the setback scenario is so having a setback, minimum setback of 20 metres would help or assist in terms of nutrient attenuation and preventing that from occurring. But I guess the more important part of the evidence of why larger setbacks are important, especially for our lakes, is because of that marginal flooding that occurs in those years, just the massive amount of nutrients that gets leached when those areas get inundated. That should answer your question. And I guess the other point is, no one is suggesting that a 20 metre setback in isolation will
jet pack, but I was thinking, can we start with something that does actually apply to all lakes?
Yes.
And before we start at the other end, which is to say, well, let's work out all the differences first. In relation to Table 2, I see a listing which gathers them, and it does note the geomorphological categorizations, which shows the variety that you're talking about. Is there anything, either by Osundashi or you, that would provide a layperson or farmer with more of a description or narrative of how those 12 groups have been identified?
I think that could be developed for us in the question.
Because I'm just thinking that I'd need to question you for a very long period of time, I suspect, to work out how Group 1 had been gathered together. You probably could actually say, oh, well, this is the key to it. I mean, the main thing, as I understand it, in terms of what you're saying here, and this is, I think, again, a perennial problem with taxonomy. What is the central point that the person doing the taxonomy is using as their gathering point, right?
Yes.
So if you could go through in due course, perhaps, and maybe prepare for the submissions in closing that might be presented, and indicate what would be the summary point, the taxonomic point you were using to gather those together.
Yeah, I just wanted to clarify, I think it's 59 lakes, I think you said 73. Mr. Clay, it's 59 named lakes, isn't it?
So we've identified the 58 at this stage. There are a couple that are listed, shall we say.
I'm sorry, I've got 73 of paragraph 10.8.
Yes, so that is the approach that was used for, it wasn't just solely within PC1. Apologies.
So I'm not seeking to give evidence from the bench about it's more than 10, so I need assistance.
Well, you're possibly ahead of me, sir. I think that 73 is outside the PC1 area.
So oh, all right. Well, in any event,
yes, thank you.
Mr. Clay, you should rest assured I'm talking about those lakes that are within the scope of PC1.
Understood.
Don't need you to go beyond that. If that, and so I think Table 2 indicates 73, so you can cut that down straight away. But nonetheless, what I'm really looking for might be a third column, which would be what's the thing that pulls these ones together?
So the key driver, the key to those categories.
That make you and Osundashi think this is a better way of grouping them than volcanic, peat, riverine, and dune.
So just to clarify, there's 4 key different variables that we use that are common accepted drivers for lake processes, and those were written off very often, but I can certainly try to tease out the key ones for each of those and get them out of around
Was it a multivariate scoring process where essentially this is a result of how they scored on the 14 factors? So there may not be a common factor among them. It's a score.
It's a score, but it's, for each of those categories, there's probably something that should be teased out, which one is the most significant bunch of the question correctly.
As I say, it seems to me that it would be what would be something which a lay person could appreciate as being why Blue, Lower Tana, Upper Tana, Paparoa should be managed differently to Rotongaro, Rotokawa, Rotongaroti.
Yes, I understand.
Thank you. Anything else? Thank you very much for your evidence. Please.
Thank you.
heads witness for Fishing Day is Dr. Adam McDaniel. Your name is Adam Joshua Daniel, and you are employed as a fisheries manager for the Auckland Waikato Fish and Game Council at the Hamilton office.
Yes, I am.
And you've prepared two statements of evidence, one dated 28th of July 2023 and a rebuttal dated 11 August 2023, and you participated in joint witness conferencing on the 4th and 5th of September. Do you confirm to the best of your knowledge and belief that your evidence is true and correct?
Yes, I do.
I have one question to ask you, Dr. Daniel. In your rebuttal evidence, you discuss whether we can say phosphorus or nitrogen is the most important nutrient to manage in the Waikato River. Now, at the point of this discharge hearing, Mr. Kirk, giving evidence, commented that this needs to be considered on a catchment by catchment basis along the Waikato. Can you comment on that?
Yes, I can. I think the important thing there to consider is that the water all ends up in the same spot. So if we are over allocated at the estuary or the bottom of the river, then it's hard for me to imagine what catchment, you know, anything you add up river is going to. There is attenuation, but in general, if you put anything in further up, if you're already over allocated at the bottom, you're not helping. So it would be hard for me to imagine a scenario where that would work out.
Thank you. Please remain in after any questions.
Good afternoon, Dr. Daniel. Just wondering if you could turn in your evidence in chief to page 15.
Yes.
And you've got there a discussion of buffer wood and a picture in figure 3 of the Mangatutu stream, I understand. And I'm just wanting to use that picture there as a bit of a test case, perhaps, for looking at some of the provisions and setback requirements and the like.
Yes.
Now, just to check, is that a photo you took yourself? You're familiar with that area?
Very familiar, yes.
Excellent, that's helpful, thank you. So, you've described there is we're seeing, I take it, the larger water body to the left is the Mangatutu stream?
It is.
And then you describe a small intermittent or ephemeral spring, which I think is the wet soil coming across from right to left in a reasonably potent manner by the looks of it. Is that what you're referring to there?
Yes.
The bare earth area to the right side of that picture, is that a track of some kind?
It is a race that is used intermittently.
So a race for stop.
It
should travel along.
It is used as that, but I don't think it's intended as an actual race that is maintained.
And looking at that picture, the distance between the edge of that race, say where it looks like there's a person there, and just to the left of where the person is, from there to the edge of the stream itself, what would the distance there be?
That location is about 3 metres. That race gets down to within a metre.
Okay, so it varies along that.
It does.
That length, but in that particular location, it's 3 metres. Does it get narrower because of other constraints on the other side, or is it just happens to meander?
It is a fence that runs on the other side, or a forestry block.
Okay. In terms of the setbacks that have been stored, is your understanding the fishing game proposal is a 10 metre setback with stock streams that would include this stream?
Yes.
And then on the other side for the council, the proposal is 3 metres, you're familiar with that?
Yes.
And so this would be an example of a scenario where a 3 metre setback, at least in the places we can see, excepting that there's some narrow parts that might need to be dealt with, a 3 metre setback would enable that race to continue to be used for the farming operation if that's what was needed.
In this scenario, yeah, it would look like that, yes.
Yes, and so then a 10-metre setback would presumably require the farmer to find some other means of getting stock for it. You might have some knowledge about what's not on this picture that answers that in a different way. But
yeah, this location is actually dockland, and the farmer did not have permission to be running cows in the first place. So I believe they are now have taken out 2 rows of the forestry and moved their race considerably further back.
Right, now I understand you were smiling when I first started asking the question. Thank you. Have you got a copy of the Regional Council's post-conference and provisions? I think there's a copy there in the corner of the desk. Find that. And if you could go to page 47 of that, which starts at Schedule D2.
Yes, I will help you.
Great, thank you. So these are the requirements to farm environment plans, farm requires consent. Now, if we step over a couple of pages, one page to goals and principles, and the bottom of page 48. You'll see here that there's a series of goals, and under each goal is a principle, and a series of principles. If we look at goal 4, which is on the top of page 47, you'll see there that the goal of a farm environment plan, one of them is to minimise losses of nitrogen, phosphorus, sediment, and microbial pathogens to waterways. And to do so, principles 10, 11, and 12 would be relevant. Now, in terms of that picture, in the pre-intervention state, principle 10 would presumably lead to identification of that ephemeral spring as an area of at risk of overland flow, leading to a need to implement measures to minimise transport of contaminants. Would you agree with that?
I would, and I did ask the farmer in this situation if he had a plan. He said yes, but he must have missed this spot. And the plan was produced, in his words, by Volunteer. So I agree with that wholeheartedly, but I guess in this example, that doesn't always translate to what happens on the ground.
Nice, thank you. And then moving to principle 11, there it talks here, locate and or manage farm tracts, etc. Another critical source here is to minimise risks to water quality. So if this was treated as a current example, not the way it's currently been changed in terms of the moment of stream, but in terms of what's in the picture, if the council proposal was enforced and there was a 3 metre from the stream fence, and that race was still being used, then presumably the wetter area, the ephemeral spring, would be identified as an area where the farm track needed to be managed differently or relocated. Would that be fair in terms of the way this principle would apply?
That is absolutely correct, but in this case we had asked him to move that several times, and it was identified or was not identified in his farm plan. So until he was forced to move it, he didn't, in this case. But yes, I do acknowledge that all of those things in the farm plan were enforced, that could mitigate this particular picture. But he did have a farm plan, and nothing did change until he was asked to move by the landowner, which was the Department of Conservation.
Thank you, Dr. Tennant. That's very helpful.
questions there. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Dr. Daniel. Now, you're a freshwater ecologist. That's right, isn't it?
That's right.
So I do have some questions about matters pertaining to water quality, and in particular, riparian planting. Before I get into it, though, I just want to try and get some clarity for my own sake. Are you proposing that within riparian margins required under Schedule C of the plan, and stop me if you're not familiar with the planning terms and I can help you, that all of those riparian margins should be vegetated with trees, black shrubs, those sorts of things, what we might collectively call woody vegetation?
I think that in an ideal scenario to improve ecosystem health,
yes,
that's where I agree that yes, shading is very important, and having a continuously vegetated edge is important for ecosystem health, yes.
Right. And so, does that mean you don't see a place for riparian plantings that do not consist of woody vegetation, in other words, grass swards or rank grass, or is it that you just prefer to see woody vegetation?
I would say that I would prefer to see woody vegetation. And one of the reasons for that is because we, in terms of trout habitat, which I prefer fishing game, and some native habitat, you know, having that shade can be the difference of 4 degrees. We are on the edge of where trout can live in New Zealand, and we regularly get streams that are too hot. So the difference between rain grass and the woody vegetation might be a 4 degree peak temperature rise during the summer.
Okay. So, well, that's helpful. What I want to ask you about is the sheep and beef sector and how this applies to it or them, however you want to refer to it. And particularly extensive hill country farms. So you know what I'm referring to when I'm talking about extensive hill country farms?
Spent the weekend in the Wanganui area or Tamanui, so yes.
Right. Okay. And so you've presumably, I don't recall seeing you here throughout the whole hearing, presumably your council has told you that my clients and federated farmers have been clear they accept sediment as a particular contaminant of concern for extensive sheep and beef farms. We've been quite open about that. You know that?
Yes.
Right. And you talk about Pingarap 2019, which is discussing ecological stresses.
Yep.
That Pingarap study identifies sediment as one of the top four drivers of ecosystem health, and it's a significant factor, I think. My words, not yours.
Yes.
So, if we're just thinking about sediment losses to water, and we're thinking about woody vegetation, if I understand correctly, the alternative to woody vegetation might be something we call a filter strip, which might be rank grass or something similar. And the way they work is effectively as entrained sediment moves towards the water body, the rank grass will effectively slow the velocity of the water, is that right?
Yes. Yeah.
And that will cause the sediment to get effectively caught in the filter trap, right?
Sure, yes.
Okay, so that would be particularly helpful on hill country if we've got a slope, right?
Yeah.
And so to the extent that we're relying on woody vegetation, so bigger trees and flaxes and those sorts of things, it would be correct, wouldn't it, that a low vegetated area of rank grass or something is going to be important if you're trying to deal with sediment?
Yes, you're right, it could be. Yep.
Okay. And so, if the contaminant of most interest to us is sediment, effectively rank grass or a grass sward is going to do the job more effectively than woody vegetation on its own.
I really think it depends on the what kind of woody vegetation. I mean, if you're envisioning nothing but adult trees, then you they could, but I believe shrubbery could be even better. I think Zane had a section on that.
Who's sorry?
Zane's paper that has been referenced several times in the hearings. But rank grass can be effective, but there are other effective vegetation types that would work.
Okay. And so, are you familiar with the riparian buffer design guide that was included in Dr. Crystal's literature review?
No, you have a copy? It doesn't come wrong.
Okay. So that's at tab 29 of the secondary materials in the common bundle. I have a copy for you, sir, if that's in the court, if that's convenient, but otherwise it's under tab 29. I don't know what colour it is, sorry, and my eyesight's not that good. But it's the secondary materials behind you. It might be brown.
I'm sorry.
Well, in the interest of moving things along, I can provide my copies, Your Honour, if anyone has a concern with that.
Yes.
Might be quicker. I just want to check with you, if I take you to page 8, in the middle paragraph there, we've got on page 8 of this paper quite a, what I think, quite a useful layperson's description of how filter strips work, and in the middle column there, you see that there is a sentence which I will read to you. It's about 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 lines down. It says, trees and shrubs can be part of a filter strip as long as a dense ground cover is present to provide roughness and slow surface runoff. Do you see that?
Yes, yeah.
And you accept that proposition?
I do.
Okay.
Cool. Yep.
Thank you. So, if you accept from me for a moment that a key outcome we're trying to achieve here is not to go backwards and to try and make some gains quickly when it comes to water quality, which I'm sure it's not something you object to. Filter strips are an effective mitigation to make gains for invertebrate and fish health, because that's what Pingram told us, didn't he? I'm not saying perfect, I'm just saying in general terms. You would accept that proposition from me?
Well, I think what Pingram identified there was that an intact riparian zone was correlated with in-stream habitat, you know, large wood, which is also very important. So yet in a simplistic means, grass can stop sediment, but in terms of stream health, you need trees and something to stabilize the bank. Grass isn't very good at creating in-stream habitat or stabilizing the bank. So yes, I do agree with you that it will stop sediment, but it's not going to shade the stream or create in-stream habitat, or stabilize the banks, which are also other very important points that are mentioned in the paper.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. Nothing further. Thank you.
Mr. Rudd?
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Meesaw? Okay. Thank you. Mr. Fuchs?
And Dr. Daniel, it's pretty
broaden the issue of any buffer width and other mechanisms in terms of riparian management. But I just wondered, in terms of fencing, have you got experience in relation to the kind of challenges that have been discussed with a number of other witnesses regarding the practicality of fencing, particularly as one gets up into the greater slopes beyond 10 degrees, 10 degrees, 15 degrees?
I have fenced areas of floodplains, and I've certainly seen fences on very steep property along this weekend as well. But I'm not a farm systems expert or a farmer.
And you can't kind of comment on the difficulty of not having fencing or beaching in those circumstances?
Well, I think actually David Clayton has done a lot more there than I have. But no, I cannot make comment on
that. Okay, yeah. Thank you. That's great. Thanks.
Thank you.
No, thank you,
sir. Good afternoon, Daniel. I'd just like to pick up on some questions that was just been asked about different types of buffer zone vegetation. And one of the issues that come up is that there are a number of streams where you can see quite a lot of bare rivers, and they would obviously be, I guess, one of your priorities for doing something about. One of the things we have to be careful of is over-prescribing when something isn't necessary and costs a lot of money. So in a situation where we want flexibility, is there any guidance you can give us on how that should be provided in terms of saying, if you've got certain types of situations there, you need to consider certain types of vegetation? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Could you, make the question more specific? You're asking me to, if there's any recommendations I have for certain farm types or stream bed types in terms of replanting.
It's stream bed types I'm thinking of in particular, and situations where you might have a large exposed area of bank, for example. In that situation, would you be talking about a tree-type situation?
I think that stabilizing the banks, most of the literature does say that you will improve that sort of slumping bank scenario with setbacks over time. Having it revegetated is going to armor the banks. I think my evidence also does cover that. The wider that width is, the more natural area there is for the stream to meander and to expand, because in general terms, when you fence a stream off, that stream bed will expand. You will reduce the downsize and the income. But, shrubbery with some shade is the most important part, whether that's willows or macedonia willows, not scrub willows, or flax. Either way, as long as the stream size is shaded, then you get considerably more ecological benefit, in my opinion. And one of the most important things, I think, for me, especially for native species, is that I do not see them in areas without trees, because the trees then don't fall into the river to create some stream habitat. And that was covered in that Ingram paper, that there's a real correlation between an intact riparian zone and in-stream habitat.
Okay, so basically, is it fair to say that we can't be too specific? We've got to allow flexibility for on-site inspection to determine the best way to go.
I wouldn't disagree with that. I'm more concerned about having a continuously vegetated edge to begin with.
Right.
And as you expand that into something that looks more like a forest along the side of the stream, the more ecological benefits you get.
Thank you very much indeed. Thank you.
I have no further questions. I do just want to check, Mr. Thompson, is this actually this document already in the second resources bundle?
Yes.
All right, well, that's fine.
Tab 28, as far as I have called you out. Yes.
Thank you. Second resources, so it doesn't need to be exhibited.
Is there anything arising?
No. Thank you. Thank you very much for your evidence, Dr. Dancy.
The only issue that was referred to was like the revised provisions for that. Do you solemnly sincerely and truthfully declare and affirm that the earth and the object of the court shall be approved the whole truth and nothing but the truth? Yes. Your name is Helen Rowe-Ma and you're a senior planner at Carver Environmental, of which you are also a director.
Yes.
And you have provided two statements of evidence for these proceedings, one dated 28 July 2023 and a rebuttal of 11 August 2023, and you attended joint witness conferencing on the 11th to the 14th of September. Do you confirm to the best of your knowledge and belief that your evidence is true and correct? So, in response to issues that Dr. Crystal raised around FNPs being living documents, you have proposed some changes to the attachment to your evidence in terms of trip changes to PC1. Would you like to briefly set out what you've done?
Yes. In response to Dr. Crystal's evidence about FFPs being a living document that should be updated regularly and be seeking continuous improvements, she raised concerns that the wording that I proposed in Policy 1 about implementing a plan within 8 years was too rigid and didn't allow for that continuous improvement. So I reconsidered those provisions and suggested some changes to address the issue Dr. Crystal raised. Those are set out in the document that was only handed up. In summary, that changes to delete the Clause E, Policy 1 that I had proposed in my evidence, and instead to rely on the provisions of Policy 2, which talk about reducing contaminant losses to as low as practical within an appropriate specified period. Policy 2 already contains a clause which talks about how you might determine an appropriate specified period. I've proposed changes in purple that talk about ensuring that the measures that are required to reduce contaminants to as low as practical are completed within that 8-year period, but not to foreclose that there would be further reductions in contaminant loss, but just to talk about that appropriate specified here and that first time that change has been completed within the 8 years. I recognise that, again, Policy 1 and 2 have got very competitive with the track changes, so I've provided a clean version just so you can read that particular clause in its whole as I suggested.
Sorry, I don't think I've handed up the clean version, so the court
it's attached to the whole one. It's at the beginning of the policy.
It's right at the front.
Oh, I
see. So it's the tiny amount of type that there's no.
Oh, yes, I have missed that.
Yes.
Thank you. Please remain where you are, Ms. Meyer, and answer the question. Mr. Cotton?
Good afternoon, Ms. Meyer.
Good afternoon.
Now, I've got to ask you some questions, stepping through some parts in your evidence and check if you've got that there. And the first place I'd like to take you to is paragraph 89, which is on page 24, where you are discussing objective 5.
Yes.
And you've explained the reasons why you seek the inclusion of reference to hydrological drivers in the
Now, I'm looking at those words, and it may be a drafting thing, but I guess I'm trying to understand precisely how you see those working in the context of this objective.
Mm-hmm.
I understand your intention is to mean that when applying this objective, hydrological drivers are considered rather than that hydrological drivers are restored and protected.
Yes, so my intention is that when considering the contaminants, one also considers the hydrological drivers of how those contaminants are released. Because it's my understanding of the evidence of Mr. Clay and Dr. Brooks in particular, that those factors are so interrelated that they can't be separated from each other in relation to the farming and the land.
Yes, and that's helpful because I guess it's a question of how integrated this might need to be, and also how integrated it already is.
Mm.
And taking that point that the hydrology is so fundamentally connected with the contaminants, would another way of looking at it be that if we accept that as being the case, it's inherently already contained within the subjective, that whether you say must or can, it would be consistent with the subjective to consider matters relating to hydrological drivers. Do you accept that without the words you did?
I think without the words I've added, one could argue that hydrological drivers should be considered and must be considered. But I think it is a matter of argument. I think it could be argued either way. And in my opinion, writing objectives that have an element of argument in them, when it's possible to clarify those things in the policy document, they should be. And so, in my mind, it is more efficient to say what we mean in the objective than to leave it to be read between the lines.
Stepping back from this particular objective and looking at objectives 1 and 2, for example, in relation to the four contaminants, hydrology or pathways through soil or simply gravity, is the mechanism or the pathway through which those contaminants reach water, isn't it?
There are many mechanisms by which contaminants enter water, and the plan deals with a number of all sorts of them. I'm not sure what the question is in relation to the objective.
Well, if we were to look at objective 5 with a specific reference to hydrology as a pathway for those contaminants, that would be a difference from the way that objectives 1 and 2 deal with those four contaminants, wouldn't it? Objectives 1 and 2 don't refer to hydrology or overland flow or other pathways.
No, they don't refer to pathways. I view them as objective 1 and 2 also apply to Whanganui, you know, the wetlands and lake complex there. They apply to that because they apply to all water bodies. So they apply, they're quite, I perceive them as the high level objectives. As you got the high level objectives for the plan change and policies, 3, 4, 5 specifically set out some more specifics in specific circumstances. So I don't think that policy 5 needs to look exactly the same as 1 and 2 because there is that increasing level of specificity in this policy. I think it's also relevant that policy 16, policy 16, which deals with the Whanganui wetland, does have that specificity about hydrological drivers as well. And so I think it's useful that policy 16 and objective 5 speak the same language because they're dealing with the same water body.
didn't have the words in Objective 5 that you have sought, then it would be possibly quite clear on Policy 16 that it's inherent, couldn't it?
Possibly. If somebody's reading the whole plan, then that would be helpful. But I think, as I said, it's much better to be clear where we can be clear. If we can add some words that add clarity, aid interpretation, and avoid inefficient arguments later on, then in my view, it's more appropriate to do that than to not do it.
I might observe that's probably why this has become such a long set of provisions.
There are a lot of reasons for why this is a long set of provisions.
Turning now to the Whangarei FMU that you have sought recognition of, the request to have a separate FMU in Whangarei Wetland, you discussed that on page 36 of your evidence sheet, from paragraph 126.
Yes.
Now, you still had a range of bits of discussion there, but to step back from that, the legal submissions that Ms. Onley has presented today talk about the importance of communicating clearly to landowners the unique biophysical issues and challenges facing the Whangarei Wetland, and this is one of the purposes of FMU. So you'd agree with that statement?
It's one of the matters that's relevant in deciding on appropriate new boundaries. I would agree,
yes. And it's important that the plan does clearly communicate the particular situation that the Whangarei Wetland is in and that actions will be needed in order to restore it. Do you agree with that?
It's important that the plan, set objectives and policies for how it is going to be restored, and if it's necessary to set out contextual information in order to do that, then yes. Generally, plans are not very good at communicating with ordinary people, and councillors usually use different tools to do that. Does have a role in being clear so that when people understand, read it, they should understand what is happening in the Tisimon area. Yes, Whangarei Wetland is such an important, internationally important wetland and important for this region as well that should be pulled out for special management. And it should be clear what that management is required to achieve.
Yes, and that is why, as I understand it, and you referred in paragraph 128, the plan already has its own objective for Whangarei Wetland and its own policy and its own rule managing farming within the catchment, which, as you said there, imposes a high level of control. And it's also why farms in the Whangarei sub-catchments are among the first to require resource consent. So those are, you've identified them helpfully, those are very clear indications within the plan for someone reading through, particularly someone who's in that sub-catchment as a farmer, that outline what's the issue and what's required to deal with it. Would you agree with that?
Well, they are, I've set out what the plan already does to Whangarei, which is a lot of things and which I think should remain. And then I have set out some things that it doesn't do and that I think having Whangarei as a separate FMU would help to achieve. So some of those things are FMUs are used as the framework for water trading, nutrient trading, offsetting, whatever phrase we'd like to use. It's important that scale is appropriate with Whangarei as well. The plan also has a role in, because it sets the FMU, it has a role in directing freshwater monitoring and accounting and reporting, and that should be the appropriate scale for the Whangarei as well. It's a whole, what I have tried to do is look across the package of things that needs to be achieved for Whangarei and then analyse provides all of those things. And in my evidence, I said that there are some gaps that setting out a separate FMU would fill.
Turning to the policies that have been tabled today, just want to take you through some parts of those and clarify a few matters from my understanding. So if you've got that in front of you there, very good. Now, policy one, the purple change in E, you've confirmed today, that's an addition you had stored, but you are now proposing to no longer stick that there, but essentially cover that off in policy two.
That's correct.
So we'll come back to that in a moment. Then we've got the green paragraph F at the end of policy one, and you've got a comment in the margin saying this was agreed in Plan JWS question 7. And I just want to clarify, my reading of that JWS is that some of the planners at the conference and agreed with that, but some did not. Is that your understanding too?
That is my understanding.
Thank you. Now, in terms of that additional wording there, where it says, ensure existing farming activities do not increase the risk of diffuse discharges of nitrogen, phosphorus, sediment, and microbial pathogens over time. Now, another way to deal with that sentiment is to have wording in policy one that says ensuring that records are kept to demonstrate that the risk of diffuse discharges of nitrogen, phosphorus, sediment and microbial pathogens to water bodies is not increasing over time. Do you accept that conveys a very similar sentiment?
Ensuring records are kept to demonstrate.
Yes, that the risk to water bodies is not increasing over time.
It does sound similar. I just have a concern that ensuring records are kept is a slightly different emphasis than ensuring risks don't increase. That makes me a little bit nervous, because keeping records doesn't reduce risk.
Understood. So your concern would be around the emphasis rather than about the
yes.
The general sentiment.
The sentiment is the direction that's important rather than in this case how it's placed.
Yes, thank you. Now, can we go into policy two? And I'll use the tracked version because there are some words in there that have been added that I've not thought attention to. The first is in large B, small B, where it says set out in Schedule B. And this is referring to farming activities with a moderate risk of diffuse discharges set out in Schedule B. Now, my understanding there is that what you're proposing to do is identify that it's Schedule B that categorises activities into moderate, high or low risk, is that right?
That's right, and just to clarify, the words set out in Schedule B are from the decisions version. They had been deleted in previous versions, so I've deleted them, if you like, shown them in the video just to show that that's a change from my original evidence. But essentially the reason for that is so that risk of diffuse discharges is defined in some way, it's defined in Schedule B.
Yes. And you've proposed some new wording at the start of Schedule B, and maybe we can go there in your evidence. And it's on.
I'm just wondering if could we take a break?
Yeah, it's a convenient time, thank you, sir.
Yeah. And, so you're saying we'll come back at Schedule B
and in
the version attached.